This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're bringing you a special hour of Radio Boston today. It's part of a WBUR City Space conversation and the first of a new series at City Space called Phenomenal Women. Phenomenal Women features in-depth conversations with women who've broken through as leaders in fields historically dominated by men. From scientists to athletes, journalists to artists, we'll highlight women who have risen to the top of their fields, and we'll ask them about their journey, how they became who they are today, what it took to break through and blaze new trails, and the advice they'd give to other women who are hoping to shatter ceilings and help us rethink so many different aspects of our society. In our first conversation, we sat down in WBUR City Space with Katie Ray, CEO and managing partner of The Engine, a venture capital program built and spun out by MIT. The Engine's special in the venture capital world. It focuses on what's called tough tech, technologies to solve big, messy, complex problems that are usually too hard and take too long to interest traditional investors. They focused on what they called the world's biggest problems through the convergence of breakthrough science, engineering, and leadership. Katie and I covered a lot of ground when we talked. You won't hear all of it today, but we did want to bring you highlights. Let's start with a deep dive into how Katie Ray became who she is today. Early in our conversation, I asked her whether there was a moment in her life when she first remembered breaking a barrier as a girl or a woman.
Well, I remember it very distinctly. My father was our soccer coach, was my soccer coach and my brother's soccer coach. And my brother, if you were a boy, you couldn't play on the girls' team. But I was a very good soccer player. And they were playing in a tournament, and they were a little short-staffed. So my father threw me in the boys' soccer game. And you could imagine my brother was pretty pissed off about this. I remember thinking, oh, I'm a really good, like, I can play with these guys. But there was so much emotion around it for kind of how dare you.
Yeah.
You know, there was that moment. But it was fun for me. It didn't bother me at all. But it was, you know, probably my brother pouted for at least a few days afterward.
How old were you?
I think I was probably like 14.
So at
old enough that I
aware.
Was, yeah. Yes, aware.
Yeah. And do you ever, is there anything you took from that experience all the way back then that carries forward even to now?
Just maybe a little bit of a jovial razzing with, you know, it's like, we'll all get through this. Probably more, that's what I took from it. It's like, it really wasn't that big of a deal. I didn't steal anybody's thunder. I didn't score the winning goal. And, you know, and it was kind of fun. And so I think that's been my approach to many things, which is, whatever, I'm just going to jump in. Fine, there aren't many women. It doesn't really matter. I was used to that whole, you know, very competitive sports growing up with lots of guys. And so none of that ever bothered me. Really?
That's multiple sports references. Was that a big part of your development?
It was a huge part of my development. Dad's a professor at Yale and a giant sports nut on every... I spent my whole childhood on either playing something or on the side of... it could have been anything. Any Yale football games or soccer games or basketball or... he ran the New Haven Youth Soccer League, which was this huge citywide effort to get all the kids to play soccer, which really wasn't a thing in the U.S. in the 70s.
I remember.
Yeah, it was a really big deal. And so we spent our weekends organizing and drawing fields and getting kids to sign up who were playing football instead of soccer. So, you know, everything was really centered around that.
I'm curious, over the years then, you know, we use this term code switching. I don't know if it's a term you're familiar with. Coming up in a sports world and clearly spending a lot of your time in male-dominated sports environments, then coming through the business world.
Yeah.
Did it give you code switching skills that were useful or important, I would either earlier in your career or even now?
I think it did. I think, you know, I've always been in either the business world or engineering world, science. And at least in my generation, that was very male-dominated. I mean, still is in parts of it. And I don't think I was ever afraid of that. You know, it felt very familiar to me.
What didn't?
What didn't feel familiar?
Yeah.
I had to learn the world of fundraising and business. Like, I didn't really grow up around business. My mother was a social worker and my father was a professor. So I think the language of business and being okay making money was a world that I had to get used to. That just you could have a passion and a mission and make money and that was okay. That took me a while.
And why? Why did you want that to be your path? When did that, I mean, you just said, mother's a social worker, father's a professor. How'd you get there?
Well, it's funny. I always like to get stuff done. I felt like I want to, like, get it done. And I think being a professor is a lot of thinking and learning. And it's super important. Like, I love that world, too. But I also like, you know, finishing something and winning. And that neither of those worlds are really about that. You know, I was like competitive, like if we're playing cards, I want to win. I want to, you know, I loved all that. So for, you know, my friend Blanca is here and, you know, I haven't played tennis in 20 years and she took me out last summer. It's like, she's like, whoa, slow down. You haven't played in 20 years. I was like, I want to win this game. She's like, how about we just volley, you know, get you warmed up. Yeah. But, you know, that's part of who I am. And, it's not all of who I am, but I think, I had to learn to be really good about feeling okay to compete and accomplish, and that money is not evil. You know, it can be used for good. Creating businesses can be used for good, and for the right kind of change, and that I really learned very early in my life, but I didn't quite get to the comfort zone of it until much later. And, you know, I thought I'd be a doctor. I was a biology major, thought I'd be a doctor. And spent, my dad very wisely said, why don't you go work for some doctors who are doing the kind of change you want to do? And at the end of that, I was like, I don't want to be a doctor. I want to really go figure out how business works and create, like, businesses that create a stable economy, create jobs. You know, I worked with a lot of homeless families and kids that were really on the edge of society because their parents didn't have stability. And so that's kind of what pushed me into the business world, really, because I thought I'd be a doctor, maternal child health doctor. And when I really spent time with families, I was like, oh, these are people that need, like, stable economy, great jobs. That just drew me so much closer to what felt like a passion.
A different part of the system.
Yeah, a really different part of the system.
So I want to dive into that, but we have a listener question, and I think this is an interesting one. Has your competitive drive, that desire to win, ever gotten you into trouble?
Oh, God, yes. Are you kidding?
And good trouble, bad trouble, both?
All. Definitely.
It's story time. You got to tell us.
Well, you know, it gets you, and this has lessened, although if my sister heard this, she would laugh. But, you know, things like, I grew up playing lots of card games and Monopoly, and like we were just a big competitive game family. And, you know, I, as a young girl, used to get really mad. And my sister has stories of, like, you would flip the board and, you know, like, really bad behavior. I've mainly gotten over that. but it also has driven me to, I think I've always combined it in my adult life with, you know, taking that spirit for something that feels beyond me, purposeful. And so if I'm going to fight for something that's not just for myself, I think that spirit of, like, we're going to win this, we're going to make this happen, has been what has driven me. And it was certainly a much better use of that energy than, you know, being mad about losing Monopoly.
Although it is intriguing, though, to me to hear you use the phrase bad behavior.
Yeah.
And then say you've mostly, I don't think your phrase was gotten over that, but something like gotten past that. And the reason that I raise that is when we look at, you know, both observation and research, we recognize that from a gender bias perspective, right, men much more likely to use bad behavior, use it strategically, be seen as strong for using it, right, principled and tough, whereas women, you're just being bad. And I wonder how you think about that, especially as a woman in a male-dominated, I mean, culturally fully dominated industry.
I think there are ways to win and be quite forceful without actually being a jerk and using bad behavior, unethical behavior. And I think those wins are sweeter, more long-lasting, and bring more people along. So
I get the long-lasting and the bringing people along. Tell me about the sweeter.
It is sweeter to have the people that you win with feel good about your win. Like an icky win is like, everybody's like, ooh, kind of walk away, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's more fun to win in a way that is elegant. And I think that's okay. I think it's good to own that.
So let's backtrack now. So you thought you were going to be a physician.
Yes.
You're looking at maternal and child health. You recognize a different systemic problem.
Yeah.
And you decide you want to go in that direction.
Yep.
I'm curious, did you come to that realization on your own, or were there mentors and role models who either said, no, 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 look over here, or who you saw looking over here, and you were like, oh, that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this first big one, probably my dad was very influential, actually. I think just him saying to me, if you're going to go to medical school, that's a very, that's a single-track path, really.
Yeah.
And a big commitment. It's, you know, 8 years until you're really out practicing, maybe more. And are you sure? Maybe you should dive in and research it a little bit. And he knows I'm a doer. I learn by doing. I always have. And so that was his guidance. He's like, why don't you go work with people? And so I really researched people that were doing the kind of thing I could imagine myself doing, which brought me to this very innovative program in Vermont at the Visiting Nurse Association that was working with a set of doctors and the governor to really look at insecure families, right? Food insecure, economically insecure, you know, homeless, drugs, drug addicted, youth pregnancies. So that, like, that's a tough population.
Yeah.
And so I really dove in with that group and really was mentored by people who were doctors and nurses that were doing incredible work. And I think it wasn't, but they weren't on a single track. They knew it was a systemic system problem, and there were many solutions to it. So none of them were pushing me to, oh, you must be a doctor. That's the only way to make this, the changes that we know need to happen. They pushed me to look at being a legislator or many, many things, because their view was so broad and really, really inspiring. And so I think for me, I also worked in the ER as a volunteer and saw a bunch of really tough motorcycle truck accidents. And I just thought to myself, like, I just couldn't handle it. I just, ugh, it's too much, like too much grief, too much blood. And that just, I started to think about what was more compelling to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really this incredible immigrant population in Burlington. Burlington, Vermont, who were Vietnamese children of Vietnamese mothers and fathers who were in the U.S. Army, basically, who were brought over to the U.S. because they were really ostracized. And I worked with a lot of mothers and families. And I just was so inspired by that group because what they really wanted was a phenomenal job and to educate their kids and have a home. And then I worked with a set of teen moms who also wanted the same thing. And they were often from entrenched, you know, very entrenched poverty, rural poverty. But I just felt very inspired by, like, wow, what would it be like if there were jobs that were that they could, you know, be inspired to have and be a part of? And that was really why I went to business school. So I applied to business school instead of medical school.
At that stage?
At that stage, yeah.
And at that stage, then, were there yet any women role models who were kind of rocking your world? Or did that come later?
Well,
or did it
the woman
come?
That I worked for, Janet Mundt, in Vermont, was about as powerful of a woman as you could ever imagine. And all of the women around her were unbelievable, committed, almost all nurses and doctors, but really social activists. So yes, I did know some incredible people who were guiding all of the Vermont legislature. They were testifying in Congress to make these national programs. Yeah, I did. None of them were business people, but they were real role models for having conviction, standing up for what was right, incredible work ethic, incredible mentors, but they weren't telling people what they had to do. They were guiding them on a path, an inspired path, really. And I think that was incredibly lucky for me.
So I want to connect some dots here because you've taken us to business school.
Yeah.
And you've taken us to business school via, really, it sounds like a repeated set of experiences in the social change space. And learning about things like what we would call the social determinants of health, right? The systems, things like food security and housing, for example, access to quality transportation, et cetera, that drives health. So, you know, the venture capital space is not one that has, it's back at the you turn over the monopoly board or you buy the whole board kind of space, right? Not the Visiting Nurse Association of Vermont space. So how do we get from, we go to business school and you've had these fierce role models in the social change space, and you connect the dots to venture capital?
Yeah, so this happened pretty quickly in some ways. So I went to business school, and I really am not a very fearful person. So I went to school, met a whole bunch of people. I was like, wow, you all have done things that seem so weird to me. Like you want money, but you're not sure why you want money, or you know, or there was lots of forestry students who wanted to learn business. So like there were these pockets of people that are like, oh, these are interesting humans. And some guy put up a note, like he was selling a used car with little tabs. Hey, looking for somebody to help me write a business plan. And I literally called the guy. He was a computer scientist at the Yale School of Computer Science, whatever it is, that department. And he said, well, what do you know about this? And I said, absolutely nothing, except I have a fighting spirit and I could probably write a little bit. And so I just jumped in. I was like, I don't know any of this. I'm just going to learn. I know why.
Why?
I don't even, because I could.
Okay.
And because it seemed like something I knew nothing about and it could be really fun. And so I started hanging out with a bunch of computer scientists who had an idea for a business. And I was like, I don't really know anything about this, but I said I was coming to business school to learn how to start a business or run a business. And so we started driving up to MIT because they had one of the only true business plan competitions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love these guys, so I was like, we are going to win this competition. And so we used to drive up once a week to all of their mixers here. It was MIT 50K at the time, now it's the 100K. And in those mixers, we'd show up at like the MIT Museum, and they'd have invited, you know, 50 or 100 venture capitalists and angel investors. And I kept turning and going, well, what exactly is that? And so I just started meeting people and talking to them about, oh, well, what do you do? And how did you become this? And why did you become this? And why do you like it? And, you know, and hey, what do you think about this idea? And how would you, you know, how would you grow this business? And just curiosity and some extroversion probably helped me. And then I was bonded to the people that I was helping. So I wanted to win with them. So that's how it all really got started. And from there, graduated, moved to Silicon Valley. It was 1996.
Okay, we gotta take a break. We gotta know what the business was and did you win?
Well, it was really interesting. So it was one of the largest patent settlements ever, and the founders got nothing. So if you look at Apple Time Machine, where it takes you back in everything you've ever done on your Apple laptop, it was essentially a time-ordered view of everything you've ever done. And the company raised a small amount of capital, went really hard at trying to create a business around this. It ultimately was very difficult. There was kind of a dot-com crash. And then the patent trolls picked up the patents. I think they made almost $350 million off those patents.
Yeah, I don't know what a patent troll is.
Oh, it's, oh, this is a, I didn't know what a patent troll was either. A patent troll is somebody who doesn't invent anything, but when they see an opportunity to either write a patent that could make somebody else's patent less valuable or pick up patents in a bankruptcy, they'll pick it up and then try to enforce those patents. So they're not really trying to make a business out of it, but they are trying to just make money off of IP. And that's not really the point of intellectual property. The point is it gives you a moat in which to launch something that is beneficial to society. That's why we have patents. But patent trolls are just trying to make money off those patents.
Kind of like corporate raiders on patents.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
I get that.
Yes.
That's Katie Ray, CEO and managing partner of The Engine, a venture capital fund built and spun out by MIT. Coming up next, we'll dig into the venture capital industry and what it's all about and whether Katie Ray thinks her approach is making a difference. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. Today, we're bringing you highlights from the first conversation in a new WBUR City Space series, Phenomenal Women. It's with Katie Ray, CEO and managing partner of The Engine, a venture capital program built and spun out by MIT that focuses on supporting tech and ideas that solve the world's toughest problems and therefore need a lot of patience. We've brought you Katie's origin story, so now we turn to how she brings who she is as a woman and a leader to her work in venture capital and whether she feels it's making a difference. I asked Katie Ray about the level at which men dominate the venture capital industry. I noted a statistic citing that 97% of the people working in venture capital are men, and I asked her if that was true based on her experience.
I think if you include everybody that's involved in venture capital, it's probably like 93% male. If you look at the actual decision makers, your stats are probably right. Mm-hmm. You know, the group that matters in venture capital are the ones that say yes or no to investment decisions. So they're the what we call the check writers.
Yeah.
And so you can hire lots of young people, and you've seen this trend. Lots of young women get hired. But who's writing the check is the people that I look at, running the firm, writing the checks.
What's it take to become a check writer as a woman?
You have to be able to raise money.
What does that mean? So for people who don't know this world, what does it mean to go out and raise money in venture capital?
So you have to have money to make investments. You get money from what we call limited partners. So the people who write the checks are the general partners. We raise money from limited partners who are giving us the money to invest, and then they get back a substantial portion of the returns, and then the people writing the checks get some of the returns, right? And so in order to raise money, people have to believe you're going to make them money. Mm-hmm. So that means that you have to have usually some kind of, either you're born with money, you know, I wasn't the daughter of a billionaire, so I didn't get that one, or somebody hires you as a young person, and then they mentor you for 10 years until you have enough of a track record that you might be able to go raise money. Or you take the third option, which I call crawl along the bottom of the earth, and somehow get a shot at this. I chose the third path, and for many years, I was married to an entrepreneur, started many businesses with him, and, you know, would take money that I made and put it into that business. And so I wrote checks really young in my life, but not to people outside my family. And then I decided really consciously to go from running businesses to investing, and started really just helping a whole slew of entrepreneurs. And then a man, Brad Feld, I met, said to me, well, do you want to learn how to do this more? And he's a quite successful venture capitalist. So he helped me raise the first fund. It was called Techstars, very early stage checks. You rate basically $20,000 into every company. But he said, okay, I'll be your first LP, and wrote me a, you know, small check,
a limited partner,
wrote a small check, and I raised a $2.5 million fund. And he said, okay, go ask all your friends for small checks and see if they say yes. And in 3 weeks, I raised the fund, which was very fast, and then started investing. So it was a guy, Bill Warner, who's very famous in Boston, great angel investor, phenomenal entrepreneur. He wrote me a very early check. Walt Winchell wrote me a very early check, and they all totally believed in me. And Bill, when he wrote me a check, said, you have to promise me one thing, Katie. And I said, what is it? And he said, don't let anybody else influence your decisions. I only want to see what you want to invest into. And he was basically telling me, you can collaborate, but own your decisions, because that's why I'm giving you. Like, I believe in
you. The investment was really in you.
It was in me. And in turn, my investments are really in human beings, not ideas, right? It's, I believe this person can bring about a business or a change that needs to happen. And that's kind of just how it all started, right?
And so at this point, and any answer is fine, but I'm curious, at this point, have we reached a point? I'm realizing, I'm assuming that at some point you did, and maybe that wasn't never the case, but had you reached a point here where any of this you were doing on purpose as a girl?
God, that's a really complicated question. I never really thought about it that way. I was very conscious that I might have been the only girl in most situations.
Yeah.
But I wasn't doing it because I was a girl or a woman, whatever. I was doing it because that's what I wanted to do. So it was more that. It was more, I love these crazy entrepreneurs. Wait, I want to work with them all the time. How do people do that? Oh, that guy Brad does it that way. This guy Bill does it that way. Yeah, almost everybody, until I met the wonderful Gene Hammond, who we both know, were male. And Gene was an incredible mentor to me in that time period.
Woman angel investor
in Boston. Was like the first investor in Zipcar, which was a beautiful Boston story. And totally owned her money. Like, she was a successful entrepreneur, became an angel investor. She's on the board of MIT. And she was a prolific angel investor here in Boston and a real coach to a lot of companies. And she would write her own checks and make her own decisions. She wasn't looking to anybody else to make a decision. And I loved that and really looked to her in many situations to be like, wait, how are you doing this, Jean? Like, what exactly are you up to? And Jean was great at pulling syndicates of angels together and really bringing the crowd along. So she was a really great person to learn from. But along with almost all men, other than Jean and maybe a couple of other people. But all along the way, I started to collect people. I kept saying, wait, why is it that every fund I raise is almost all from men? And so I started trying to very consciously meet women who are investors. I tried to consciously, every woman I met who I thought had enough money to be an angel investor, I'd say, well, why aren't you angel investing? What are you, you know, why aren't you using your money this way? And mostly women would say that feels way too risky. Mm-hmm. And that bugged me. So again, back to this kind of winning thing, that bugged me. And so I really decided very consciously to surround myself with people who didn't feel that way. And there were some women and lots of guys. And I just thought, I'm just going to learn as much as I can from them. And I'm going to learn how to fundraise. So David Fialco, who's also a venture capitalist here in town and a philanthropist and filmmaker, the reason, he's a really good fundraiser. And I just said to him, and the reason I even ended up at The Engine is I called him and I was raising a fund. I was thinking about raising a next fund. And I said, David, you're the best fundraiser I know. How do you do it? What are you doing that I do? Like, mm-hmm. You know, how do I break to the next level? And he very consciously over a number of years kind of sat me down at each time I was raising and was like, well, give me your story. What are you saying? Like, how are you describing the opportunity? And he didn't say to me, you describe it like a girl. Mm-hmm. He could have. He was basically like, hold on. How are you going to make money at that? And how are you going to make a lot of money at that? And he was just pointing me to, wait, that's how you win this game.
Yeah.
And of course, I like to win. So I was looking for the right path there. And the comfort with talking about money, talking about making money, which is a really important part of what we do, right?
And a gender, historically, a male trait, yeah, more than a female trait, in the States at least.
I think so, but I think, you know, I work with a lot of scientists and engineers, and they don't really grow up in the world of money either. So for me, it was really important to feel okay about that. And, you know, if you're going to invest into new ways of generating clean energy, like fusion or deep geothermal, these are people that must be expert in their field. And they must talk the language of business.
So let's pick up there. So now we get to The Engine. And Stephen, I see this question. I am going to pick up on it a little bit. We get to The Engine. And what's interesting about it is, it's a spinoff from MIT, and it is focused on this idea of tough tech, which means you can't as easily sell, this is how you're going to make a ton of money on this, at least in the time frame the funding cycles usually go, because these are the tough, this takes me back to Vermont, yeah, right? These are the toughest, gnarliest, systems-level social impact problems that you're talking about now. So one interpretation of that is it's the biggest, toughest thing you could take on. The other is, are you crazy, right? Clearly you felt like biggest, toughest, worthwhile thing to take on. Was it ever scary? Is it scary now?
No, not scary at all. Any time you're in venture, you 99% of what people are trying to do goes wrong, but if 1% goes right, you can have an enormous win, mm-hmm. right? These are startups trying new things, but you just need a little bit to go right if you have some good people and some good inventions. So you live in the world that, like, oh, that didn't quite work right. So I was quite comfortable with that world. And never worried about that truly. What I worried about was, how could I help these people win? How could I help this founding team win and find their path? That's what I worry about. And I think that just has kept my feet on the ground. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's not frustrating sometimes, or I don't want them to go faster, but that's what I worry about.
So in this space, you know, we've talked a lot about, this is Phenomenal Women, so we've talked a lot about gender, especially more traditional conceptions of gender. One of the things, and we have touched on financial privilege and the role that it plays or doesn't play in having access to capital and being able, you talked about crawling on the earth floor. Of course, there's race, there's ethnicity, there's so much more here. And I wonder if investing in these tough social problems that lean into people who've dedicated themselves to the kind of research, for example, that researchers at MIT might mm-hmm. do, is an opportunity to level the playing field in some other ways, too, and how you're thinking about that.
Well, I think if you look at, yes, the answer is definitively yes. If you look at what the top universities have done, and it's never enough, right? Because we need to continually improve. But you look at the incoming engineering classes, it is very diverse, gender 50-50 ratio of engineering students. Certainly in my day, that was not the case at all. You look at a lot around making sure they're underrepresented minorities, men and women and other genders as well. You look at people from all over the world, not just, you know, we always hear about China, oh, we have lots of grad students from China, but people from all over the world. And the universities play a huge role in giving people many, many opportunities.
I gotta imagine that could lead to, I mean, more lived experiences, more parts of the world, more senses of self, right, could lead to an explosion of creative problem solving, especially given the challenging problems that almost always disproportionately affect those who are least enfranchised, most vulnerable, most marginalized in the first place.
Yeah, and I think if you look at what tough tech can solve, it can't solve everything, right? So you're looking at breakthrough technology that can have a huge positive impact. So, you know, one of the core central themes today is, of course, climate change. And the impacts of climate change disproportionately affect the poor, the disenfranchised, the less wealthy area, you know, whatever. But the solutions, and there are many, right? Technology, breakthrough technology is not the only solution, but super important. So we think it's important that everybody who is in there and has the knowledge and has the drive has the ability to think, I could be the reason this changes for the positive, not just one gender or one race, right? Or a very few number of people, because we need so many solutions. So if it's only the white dudes that can start things, that's really going to keep a lot of other people out. And so we want to make sure that everyone is inspired, that everybody feels that they will be backed. Now, we are a venture capital firm, so we are putting other people's money to work. But there are so many good ideas from so many different people who look different or from different places.
That's Katie Ray, CEO and managing partner of The Engine, a venture capital fund built and spun out by MIT and part of our conversation from Phenomenal Women, a series at WBUR City Space. Coming up next, I ask her what advice she'd give her younger self and what she'd say to other women hoping to break through barriers the same way she has. You're listening to a special Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today we're bringing you highlights from the first conversation in a new WBUR City Space series, Phenomenal Women. It's with Katie Ray, CEO and managing partner of The Engine, a venture capital program that focuses on supporting technologies and ideas that solve the world's toughest problems. In this highlight, we pick up with a sneak peek at one of the investments The Engine is making right now that has Katie Ray most enthusiastic.
SolenoBio, started by a spectacular woman, Nabiha. She is a physicist, did her undergrad at Emory and her PhD at Harvard, and grew up all over the world. Her parents were diplomats, so very, very large worldview. And she said all of the new biology, you know, new cures or million-dollar cures. I want to combine physics with semiconductor process and biology and bring true biological cures to everyone. So I want to bring down the cost by creating a manufacturing ability for these things. Just dead on, mission, smarts, could pull a team together, and she's got so much ahead of her that I think we will all in Boston be proud of her around. That's really fun, because think about all the things we can't cure with drugs, mm-hmm. like macular degeneration. Almost everybody above 70 will get it, and lots of people lose their vision. Could you replace the back of the eye at low cost? That would be amazing.
A couple more lightning round. Favorite color?
Red.
Iced coffee, hot coffee, both?
Both.
Favorite book?
Oh, way too many.
First one that came to your head.
Well, I'm reading Hamnet right now, which is about Hamlet. It's about Shakespeare. Has anybody read? It's a fictional book. Oh, it's phenomenal.
Hands in the audience. Hamnet, it's called?
Hamnet, yeah.
All right, so we've got just a couple minutes left.
Yes.
So now I kind of want to step back and look across the landscape again. We started when you were 14.
Yeah.
I want to kind of go back a little bit. You have kids who are 23, 21, 17. I want you to go back to your 23 or 21-year-old self.
Yeah.
What's the thing you'd most want to tell her that you know now?
You know, I grew up with parents who were war babies, whose parents were very worried about money. And so they were risk averse about money. And what I would tell my kids is take your risks early. You know, it took me a long time to take a big career risk, like when I left Microsoft to start angel investing. That was a big risk. That was 2008, 2009. We were in like a crazy recession. And I was like, I just have to go do what I want to do. I wish I'd taken that. That was like 40. I wish I'd taken that risk really at 30. And so it's like, work hard, gain as much respect and as many peers as you can in your early 20s. And then be willing to take some risks. And bet it all, because it's so much fun. And, you know, we live in a very privileged place to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. Within money, resources, and smart people around us in almost any field in Boston. So it's a great place to take a risk.
Any lessons from these last 2 years, from this pandemic, that have changed how you work, how you think, who you are?
Such an in-person person. Like, I like to feel and touch and, like, you know, get to know people. And I had to learn to really meditate and calm myself down in with a lot of alone time, you know, like in a weird way. But that brought me to new places, right? So it was more being comfortable in more alone spaces. Like I had worked collaboratively with people for my entire career, always in person. And to be kind of locked in a Zoom box, that was tough. And then the other thing I learned was, I mean, watching my 17-year-old now go through high school and all those formative years without really being able to be with her whole peer set, like we had a little pod, but without that, what I watched and learned from her was how much she valued those friends in ways that I think without this pandemic, you might be a little more transactional in high school. And that just brought, you know, the people around us so much closer. And just watching her bring her friends in and value that really above most other things. And I don't, and still doing her work and all the wonderful things you do in high school, but putting that above anything else. I think COVID kind of taught me that.
Last question.
Yeah.
Are you a lucky woman?
Oh, hell yes.
So what makes you lucky?
I think I was born with certain personality traits that were not squashed. You know, bossy, I love people, extroverted. I think there is some real luck in that. But I also do believe that I have made a lot of my own luck. I have worked my buns off for years. I have been unafraid of sticking up for what I think is right, for help, for supporting a whole set of people in what they think is right. I mean, that's what I do as a living. I support entrepreneurs who are like, that's the right thing to do, and I get to support them. And that has created a lot of lucky situations for me. And I do think it's, whether you think it's the karmic wheel or however you want to conceptualize that, I do think paying it forward and betting on people, believing in people, brings an enormous amount of goodness to your life. Whether you win every time isn't the score I'm keeping. It's how many possible things could go right is the score I keep.
That's Katie Ray, CEO and managing partner of The Engine, a venture capital fund that invests in companies solving the world's biggest problems. We talked to Ray for the first edition of a new WBUR City Space series, Phenomenal Women. You can find more information about it at our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.